Russia has warned that any use of force in Ukraine's eastern region could lead to civil war. This comes as Kiev seeks to regain control after pro-Moscow uprisings in three cities. This hour, two perspectives on the crisis. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll hear from former Iraq and Afghanistan war veteran and University of Iowa Writers Workshop graduate Roman Skaskiu. Skaskiu is a Ukrainian-American currently living in Ukraine. He's been blogging about developments there. Then we'll hear from University of Iowa sociologist Marina Zolotnaya, who is an ethnic Russian who grew up in Crimea. Two perspectives on the crisis in Ukraine after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The tensions and turmoil continue in Ukraine. A couple of weeks ago, Russia annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula after a referendum there, a referendum which Ukraine did not see as valid. Yesterday, Russia warned that any use of force in Ukraine's eastern region could lead to civil war. This as Kiev seeks to regain control after pro-Moscow uprisings in three of its cities. Sunday, pro-Russian protesters seized government buildings in those three cities, and on Monday, rebels occupying one regional government building declared a People's Republic and called for a referendum on secession from Ukraine to be held by May 11th. The interim Ukrainian president calls the unrest an attempt by Russia to, quote, dismember Ukraine. And in an address on national TV, he said this was a second wave of a Russian operation to destabilize Ukraine, overthrow the government, and disrupt planned elections. Roman Skaskiu is a Ukrainian-American and a veteran who recently relocated from Iowa City to Ukraine. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and Stanford University's School of Engineering. He's also a former infantry officer who served two tours of duty in Afghanistan, one tour in Iraq. His writing appears in the New York Times, The Atlantic, and The Daily Beast, among other publications. He's been blogging about what's been happening in Ukraine and also posting on Facebook. You can find his blog at romaninukraine.com. Roman joined us via Skype just a few hours ago. Hi, Roman.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I understand you now live in western Ukraine, where there are fewer ethnic Russians, away from most of the tension, away from the border with Russia. You used to live in the capital, Kiev, in the central part of the country, I understand. Tell us, what's the sense of what's going on there now since these separatist uprisings?
Well, the sense is that the separatist uprisings were done by Russian agents. They've arrested a few of them. I think that's news. That's not the impression. There is a substantial Russian minority in the east part of the country where this is underway, but they are a minority. And it seems like as of today, the Ukrainian government is finally showing some signs that it's willing and able to defend itself, and quite a few of the separatists have been arrested, and quite a few of them turn out to be Russians.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there the risk, though, that this is the way Vladimir Putin wants it to go, because he can then do things in order to protect ethnic Russians?
I suspect that they were hoping there would be a much more support in the east part of the country for these separatists. Let me explain to you how this looked. There were somewhere from dozens to hundreds of separatists facing hundreds of police officers, and the police officers just stepped out of the way, and these separatists seized government buildings. As I understand it, they also went through the town inviting people to join them, but not that many people did. So the reaction of the Ukrainian government today was to reinforce those who they regard as the compromised police of the East, compromised by Russian agents or else sympathetic with the Russian separatists. But they reinforced them with police units from other parts of the country. And as of now, from what I was reading right before we connected via Skype, it seems like this agitation is finishing very quickly. It seems like it's over. Maybe that'll look different tomorrow, but right now it seems like it ended.
What is the evidence that this is being orchestrated from Moscow?
There were arrests on the border. Some of the leaders are ethnic Russians. One of them corresponds with Dugin, Alexander Dugin, who's a top advisor to Vladimir Putin. The leaders are ethnic Russians. That's not to say there isn't some sympathy, but it does seem like it's a minority. And I think the sympathy for the Russian separatism has gone down after some violent protests last month. There was a protest and counter-protest in Donetsk, and there was a similar event in Kharkiv. And the Russians killed a couple of the Ukrainian protesters who were actually natives of the city. And that was very shocking, I think, to a lot of the people, so that they see the violence of the separatists, and I think support for them has dwindled.
Sympathy among the ethnic Russians going down for the protesters, the separatists?
Yeah, I think so, because they saw the level of violence. It's an old strategy. It's taken place in Estonia. It's taken place in Latvia. When there are movements away from the old Soviet Union, when there are movements towards the West, it's an old strategy to bus in hooligans from Russia and have them cause trouble. This happened in 2009 in Tallinn, Estonia, when they wanted to remove a statue that celebrated the quote-unquote Soviet liberators of Estonia. The same thing, they bust in a lot of Russians and they had them riot. I'm not saying it's 100% artificial. There is some sympathy, but it is largely artificial. There's also raw footage in Luhansk and Donetsk of the separatists getting paid. There's raw footage on the internet. I posted it on my blog, romaninukraine.com.
How worried are Ukrainians about Russian action? There are tens of thousands of Russian troops on Ukraine's border. Is that being talked about? Is that a concern?
It was I guess we can call it an invasion. It was foreign troops landing in Crimea. When that invasion started, it was really scary because I didn't know how far they would go. And I know if they went, certainly if they tried to go into central Ukraine, my sense is that it would get really bad. It would be a very bloody fight. But right now, I think they're taking a much more sensible approach. And as I predicted in my article on the Daily Beast, I think the Russians are going to content themselves with Crimea. But the net result might be that they gain Crimea and lose Ukraine. Because the sense of civic duty and the sense of betrayal and the sense of anger is really high right now. And that they might have lost Ukraine, but in exchange for Crimea.
Crimea is lost. Do you believe that? Do most Ukrainians believe that Crimea is lost?
Yeah, I think so. I don't believe that 90% of the population wanted to join Russia. Surveys from last year conducted by USAID and IRI, International Republican Institute, show that about 40% of Crimeans consider themselves Russian. The referendum was a farce, but it's still a huge minority when 40% of the population considers themselves Russian. It's not nearly that high in the East, although it is significant. It's from 15 to 30%. Similar, incidentally, to Latvia and Kazakhstan. They have huge Russian minorities, too. As most people know, that transferring populations was a tactic of the Soviet Union.
What has been the impact of that loss on the people in Ukrainian society? Is it mourned? Is it talked about? Is it something people say, we can give it up if this is all the further it goes?
There are a couple of impressions. There's the sort of hardcore Ukrainian nationalist line, which says that we fight for every inch and we can't let anything go. But I think the majority of people are seeing this more practically, saying it's a loss, it's a violation, it's against international law, it's against the promise that Russia made in 1994 when Ukraine gave up the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world. Russia, part of the deal when Ukraine gave up the nuclear weapons was that Russia would recognize its territorial integrity. So it is a betrayal, and it is all those bad things, and a violation, and aggression, and against international law, for what that's worth. But it is kind of a burden. And there is a huge Russian population there that's easily agitated. So a lot of Ukrainians are thinking that this is sort of the long overdue divorce. When Ukraine gained independence in 1991, that was just the beginning of the divorce, and we needed more. And this is like the next step, and Ukraine will be better off without that easily agitated population. And Crimea is also a very heavily subsidized region. So if Russia wants to subsidize it, you know, more power to them.
You've just joined us. My guest this half hour is Roman Skaskiu. He is a Ukrainian-American, a veteran. He relocated from Iowa City, as a matter of fact, to Ukraine, a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and also a former infantry officer in the U.S. military, in the Army. And he's been living in western Ukraine, lived before in the capital, Kiev, giving us his reactions via Skype. What are Ukrainians, Roman, thinking about the West's reaction to the annexation of Crimea? The West's, meaning the EU and the U.S. Do they feel supported? Do they feel the West has done all it could?
No. A lot of them feel betrayed. They said, "Why isn't someone protecting us?" But I think they're wrong to feel this way. You know, it's against, arguably, the United States and the EU's interest to come here and, you know, have the two largest armies in the world squaring off over Ukraine. And I have been delighted to see a lot of Ukrainians sort of with a sense of that we have to do this ourselves, that we have to put on our big boy pants and figure out how to take care of ourselves. The mayor of Lviv, the western city in which I live, he made an announcement much in this regard that we should not expect anyone to help us. We need to solve this for ourselves. And I think that's the correct impression, although a lot of Ukrainians still have the childish view that somebody else needs to take care of them.
Russian President Putin says his line has been for many weeks that he's interested in protecting ethnic Russians in Ukraine. Are there ethnic Russians who are under threat?
Oh, man, this is such a huge piece of ridiculous propaganda. No, there aren't. I think this propaganda is slightly directed to the West, but mostly Putin's propaganda that Russians are under threat is directed at Russians. And let me give you some examples to illustrate this. Okay, in Lviv, Russian is spoken every day. There's a minority of Russians here. Not as big as in the East, but Russian is spoken every day. I hear it in the streets. I have personal friends with family in Moscow calling them, asking them over the phone, is it true that in Lviv, people have started beating people up for speaking Russian? There's a Russian street musician in the center of the city singing in Russian. Nobody is harming Russians, but Russians are somehow convinced that it's true. I also have a friend who works in a hotel, says for about a week there was some Russian family staying in the hotel, almost not leaving the room, just going to the grocery store and back because they believed that they would be harmed for speaking Russian. This is such an alternate reality. I can't believe how people are accepting it. So, Russians are not under threat. And that argument is extremely hypocritical, too, because, for example, no Russian language books have been burned. Ukrainian language books have been burned by provocateurs, by Russian provocateurs in Crimea and in the eastern city of Kharkiv. No pro-Russian protesters have been harmed. Pro-Ukrainian protesters have been murdered, quite a few of them during Maidan, during the protests in Kiev. And since then, in Donetsk, two pro-Ukrainian protesters were murdered by the pro-Russian counter-protesters. There's an eyewitness account about 20 minutes long that describes this. It was heartbreaking. They made them kneel. They urinated on them. The aggression towards Ukrainians from the Russians is so out of proportion to anything going in the other direction that this Putin's line that ethnic minorities are being harmed is purely ridiculous. You can also look at Crimea. Now that Russians have come there and protected ethnic minorities, you have Tartars fleeing Crimea. You have Catholics fleeing Crimea. So much for protecting ethnic minorities.
Tartars, explain these other ethnic minorities there a little bit more.
Tartars are an ancient people. They don't come from the Mongols. They actually predate them. But they were Muslim for a long time. Crimea was a Khanate. If you look all the way back to the 15th century, Crimea actually conquered Moscow, and Moscow would pay tribute to Crimea, but their population has dwindled. The population of Tartars was deported almost to a man to Siberia or to Central Asia by Stalin. They've been trickling back since the 80s and 90s, and now they make up about 10 to 15% of the population of Crimea. They fear Russians. They blame Russia for the genocide that was against them, and that they fear this Russian invasion and annexation. And some of them have been fleeing. Others are resolved to stay. One Crimean Tartar was murdered with signs of torture. They say he was talking about joining the Ukrainian army. Who knows what the backstory is? I don't think we'll ever know. But this idea of protecting ethnic minorities is a complete farce. There's a joke going around Odessa right now. One Russian friend says to another, "Why did you start speaking Ukrainian? Are you afraid that Ukrainian nationalists will beat you up?" And the reply is, "No, of course not. I'm afraid that Putin will come and protect me."
Roman Skaskiw, you will put a link to your blog, romaninukraine.com, on our website as well. But I noticed in looking at it a little while ago, and I think these are words that you wrote, correct me if I'm not right, "We need to stop being such peaceful people. Gun ownership." Are those your words?
Those are my words, yes, yes.
Explain what's behind that.
Well, Ukraine lives next to the second largest army in the world, next to Putin, whose top advisor is trying to restore the Soviet Union. Putin himself talked about the collapse of the Soviet Union was one of the greatest tragedies of recent history. The Swiss model is the best model to follow in such a situation. An armed populace can resist invasion. If you look at what fascist Italy, what Nazi Germany said about Switzerland, they were scared of going into Switzerland, a place where everyone was armed. Gun ownership is a very scary thing for a lot of people, and understandably so, but there is so much research of armed societies showing that they are more peaceful. And there are some historical examples which I noted showing that they are less often invaded. Last summer, Harvard University finished a study published a study of European countries' murder rate versus gun ownership, showing that banning guns does not improve the murder rate at all. So contrary to that impulsive sort of fear that a lot of people have, which is perfectly understandable, the data seems to show that gun ownership does reduce murder rates, crime, and I think it's a deterrent to invasion as well. And I'm thrilled to see that this conversation has exploded all over Ukraine. Even some presidential candidates are talking about it.
Would this have changed things had Ukrainians been armed more than they were before this crisis?
Perhaps the crisis would have never even happened. As most people know, the starting point for the protests in Kiev that ultimately overthrew the government was a desire to join the EU. But they changed. About 1 month into it, they changed. When Ukrainians saw how viciously the government cracked down on the pro-EU protests, it no longer became about joining the EU, although that was still a part of it and is still a part of it. But the main thrust of the protests was overthrowing a hideously corrupt regime. One of the big problems in Ukraine is corporate raiding. You know, there are people who spend all their lives building a business, and then hooligans just show up and take the business, you know, away from them. There are a few, you'd have to look back in the history on my blog, but there's a lot of stories of rival politicians getting their businesses seized, or managers of companies that don't want to compromise with the government mafia getting killed. That would go away if there was gun ownership. There was a story last harvest season about gangs just coming and seizing wheat from farmers during harvest. You know, the farmer works all year planting the crop, nurturing it, growing it, and then at harvest, hooligans just show up and take it. This mafia was connected to the government. I think in an armed society, you would never have that kind of mafia state, because people would at least protect their businesses, at least protect their livelihoods.
I wonder if you see some things happening that others might not in civilian society there. In terms of the Ukrainian military or preparations. I noticed some of your blog posts show photographs of the military and the Ukrainians' military reaction.
Yeah,
going on.
I don't have that many contacts in the military here. My general impression is that they were woefully unprepared. There was one headline that Ukraine only had 6,000 combat-ready troops, which is pathetic. The military was just a huge bureaucracy of people, you know, collecting their paychecks but not doing any kind of training or maintaining a state of readiness. So my impression is that it was pretty bad. But this whole revolution and the invasion of Crimea kind of caused a lot of Ukrainians to put on their big boy pants and realize, hey, we have to protect ourselves. No one else is going to do it for us. There was a huge flood of volunteers into the Ukrainian military. 40,000 is the number that I heard. I don't know what their training is like, and I don't know the quality of it. I don't even know the quality of their equipment, but I know there's a lot of people that are very motivated to have some meaningful national defense, and that's probably a good thing.
Before we say goodbye, I wanted to get a couple of personal notes from you. People listening to you, talking to us from Ukraine, are certainly curious as to how you came to live there, and what do you see your role now as in this crisis?
Well, my parents are from here. My parents both fled Bolshevism. I can't really say my parents. My mother was 4 years old at the time, but my grandfather had to flee the Bolsheviks. So I sort of grew up in this Ukrainian-American community in New York City, of people who were very nostalgic for their homes. They had no contact whatsoever for 20, 30 years. And then little by little, they started writing to their relatives. But for, you know, in the chaos of World War II and after World War II, for the next two or three decades, relatives of my parents didn't know whether they were alive even. So I sort of inherited this big nostalgia for Ukraine. I started visiting in 2008 after my last tour of duty in Afghanistan. And I did something in 2008 that I had been planning to do for a long time. I took my mother to Ukraine to see. We saw where she was born. I met a whole bunch of distant relatives I never knew I had. And I just saw a country that was kind of behind economically. A lot of really smart people, but not that much opportunity. A really low cost of living, really low cost of labor. So I started visiting in the next few years, and I decided to move my life here 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I have four computer programmers working for me, developing some software. That's my major job.
Roman Skaskiw, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and I hope we can check back in with you as this story develops. Thank you very much for this conversation.
My pleasure, anytime.
Roman Skaskiw, a Ukrainian-American, a veteran, a former resident of Iowa City and a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, also a former infantry officer in the U.S. Army. When we come back, we'll hear from a University of Iowa sociologist, a different perspective on the crisis in Ukraine, University of Iowa sociologist Marina Zalozhnaya, who grew up in Crimea. She's an ethnic Russian, and she'll give us her view. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
One other note, we want to thank the Iowa Public Radio listener, Christopher Peters, for making us aware of Roman Skaskiw. Thanks, Christopher, for helping us out. Back in just a minute. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, two perspectives on the crisis in Ukraine, which we hear in our news is heating up again. In the first half hour, we heard from Roman Skaskiw, a Ukrainian-American now living in Ukraine. This hour, my guest is Marina Zalozhnaya, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Iowa. Professor Zalozhnaya, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
And I understand you grew up in Crimea during the 1980s and 90s. You are an ethnic Russian, and you find yourself in the United States now. I know you have some reaction to what Roman Skaskiw said in the first half hour.
Right.
But first of all, I'd like to just ask you about the events of the recent weeks, how you interpret that through your eyes of a sociologist. and to, at your, in your homeland.
Right. You know, it has been quite unnerving and difficult to watch what has been going on in Crimea from being so far away. However, you know, from my perspective, the fact that there has not been any violence in the region where a lot of my family still live and my parents still live in Ukraine, particularly in Crimea, has been wonderful.
Your parents live in Crimea?
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the resolution of the situation in Crimea, and I would agree with Roman that the situation there is pretty stable at this point in time and looks like things are not going back anytime soon. Is not the type of resolution that me and my parents would necessarily welcome. However, I would like to disagree with Roman and say that, you know, from eyewitness accounts on the ground in Crimea, I hesitate to say that the results of the annexation were really fully fueled by Russian agents and Russian propaganda. Rather, what my parents saw, and my parents live in a quite strategic area in Crimea, in a small city on the border with Russia, the marine border with Russia, were welcomed by most of the population. Everybody but them, everybody they know but them actually voted for in the referendum.
So you're at liberty to say how your parents voted in
the
referendum?
Yes, absolutely. Just because of our—
They voted against?
They voted against.
The annexation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because of our specific family situation, because I live here and I'm married to an American and our kids are American.
Mm-hmm. Roman called it a long overdue divorce, his words. Help us understand a little bit more the relationship between Ukraine and Russia. You are both a speaker. You grew up speaking both Russian and Ukrainian?
Yes, I did. I'm actually a representative of the, you know, younger population of, you know, people in southeastern regions who were, you know, who are ethnically Russian but who already grew up and in their late teenage years and young adulthood grew up as Ukrainian. So I learned Ukrainian in school. I was preparing to apply to a Ukrainian university for college. I ended up living for the United States, but that was the original intention. So I have embraced the duality of the ethnic belonging. I consider myself both Ukrainian and Russian. Mm-hmm. However, for my parents and for a lot of people, older generation, you know, who moved to the Crimea during the time of the Soviet Union, when it actually did not matter, you know, where the peninsula belonged administratively, because there were, the borders were not enforced, the language was Russian, the primary language was Russian. For them, the breakdown of the Soviet Union and the kind of unexpected, almost forced, you know, coerced, new national identification with Ukraine was much more difficult. They had to, you know, they still don't speak Ukrainian. They understand Ukrainian, so when they watch TV, for instance, they don't even notice if it's
Ukrainian. But a person can, as a Russian speaker, can get around in all parts of Ukraine or not?
Sure, yes. Most Ukrainians do speak Russian. However, the languages are quite different. I like to compare them to, you know, Spanish and Italian. So if you don't know one, you don't necessarily know the other. The thing is that most former Soviet people speak Russian. So even if you don't speak Ukrainian, you're able to get around.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you think language is at the heart of or has played the conflict. The tensions have played themselves out through the treatment of language once Ukraine had its own national identity.
Right. Absolutely. You know, Russians and Ukrainians share 60 years of common history as a part of the Soviet Union. They look the same. The cultural traditions predating Soviet Union are also very similar. So one thing that really separates Russians and Ukrainians is the language. So it has emerged at the forefront of the ethnic tensions in the country. And, you know, I would like to disagree respectfully with Roman, who said that there has not been any kind of, you know, pressures exercised against ethnic Russians in Ukraine after the, you know, that the new temporary government has come to power, disagree specifically in regards to the linguistic issue. Because
so what have you heard from your parents, or what do you know has taken place to discriminate against Russian speakers? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I mean. The discrimination itself might have not been happening yet, but there have been several proposals, legal proposals developed by the temporary government in Kyiv that were going to demote the status of the Russian language as official. And a lot of people, particularly in Crimea, saw this as crucial to, you know, the maintenance of their ethnic identity. And as a result, we're extremely unhappy. So linguistic tensions came to the forefront. I mean, the kind of discrimination that Roman was talking about, you know, maybe beating up ethnic Russians in Lviv, maybe is not happening. You know, it's hard to say. But the move of the new government to kind of demote and decrease the area in which Russians could use their language and demoted status was undeniably going on.
I'd like to play a little bit, a very short clip of Roman Skascu that we recorded earlier, specific on this topic of language, because I knew this was a center point of what you wanted to talk about. Let's listen to Roman talk about, from his perspective as a Ukrainian American living in Ukraine, about the role that language played. And let's have a listen. Roman Skascu earlier today via Skype from Ukraine.
Since independence in 1991, Ukraine has been the official language, but there have been schools, Russian language schools. Everything has been Russian except for government documents. That's a source of agitation for the Russian population, but it's just government documents. In 2010, they passed a law that would allow also Russian government documents. The transition government talked about repealing that 2010 law, which meant no more Russian language government documents. They talked about it. It passed parliament, but the president says, no, this is unfair to the Russian minority. We're not going to sign this. We're not going to pass that law. That is it. A law was considered and voted down. Now let's talk about hypocrisy. There are Russian language schools all over Ukraine. There are no Ukrainian language schools in Russia, not one. You also have to realize that the Soviet Union tried to destroy the Ukrainian identity. They murdered thousands of cultural figures, artists, writers, painters. There were laws against the Russian language, against the Ukrainian language. Despite that legacy, Ukraine has been completely accommodating to the Russian minority.
That's Roman Skascu earlier today via Skype from Ukraine. So, Professor Zalosnaya, react to that. Do you agree with what he said?
Sure, I agree partially. In, you know, the first part of his statement, I would like to emphasize that timing is particularly important. So the law was actually not voted down by the president until the unrest have started in Crimea already. So it was a reaction to kind of the growing tumult in the southeastern regions. Now, I don't necessarily disagree that Putin and, you know, current Russian administration have been welcoming of minority languages. You know, this is not the point. The point here is that the southeastern part, Ukraine is, you know, a profoundly divided country. It is populated by two very different groups and some other minority groups. And during this time of upheaval, when the Yanukovych government was deposed, both of them started fighting for their rights, you know, so this is a political opportunity. And, you know, it's unfair to say that while we, you know, support the pro-Western Ukrainians, pro-Russian Ukrainians don't have, you know, their own right to express their own vision of political future. And that's what has been going on.
Mm-hmm. But now we have the latest news of the separatists in one case occupying a state security building, placing explosives, according to the report I hear from the BBC, holding perhaps 60 people against their will. This is in reaction to what we were talking about or something else? It sounds like the reaction, if we would ask Roman, this would be orchestrated from Moscow.
Right. Again, you know, this situation has been mirrored by propaganda from both sides, not just from the Russian side, but also from the Ukrainian government and the pro-Western interpretation of the events as well. So I hesitate to say whether or not there have been Russian agents who have been supporting the recent events in Donetsk, Lugansk, and Kharkiv. What I'm going to say is that Roman himself said that the reports really show ethnic Russians of Ukrainian origin, who have been arrested in this separatist movement, as opposed to Russian agents. There is a significant difference, right? So until we know whether or not there is actual support, I mean, it is not at all surprising that there are ethnic Russians agitating that part of Ukraine, because there is plenty of ethnic Russians, you know, up to 35% of the population are ethnic Russians who are interested in protecting their ethnic, linguistic, cultural rights.
If you just joined us, my guest is Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Iowa, Marina Zalosnaya. She grew up in Crimea and is an ethnic Russian. And we're talking about the situation, the crisis in Ukraine. And I'd like to ask you a little bit, given your research interests as a sociologist. I understand you look at organizational and economic crime, development and democratization, and some other things. Through the lens of your expertise, what do you find most fascinating about what's going on in your homeland?
Right. So one of the primary foci of my research is corruption, or kind of informal economic engagement of bureaucrats and ordinary people. And what I find particularly fascinating is that the initial protests in Kiev, the initial Maidan, was really a reaction against the corrupt government. And it was supported by both Russians, you know, or ethnically Russian Ukrainians, as well as ethnically Ukrainian Ukrainians. And I think it's a interesting process for me, as somebody who's interested in kind of the links between democratization and corruption, to observe. And I think it is also an interesting point for us to keep in mind that originally the way this upheaval started was really, you know, represented the united interests of all Ukrainians to kind of move towards a more transparent representative government. And only now has this situation, or only in more recent months, let's say, has the situation been overtaken by kind of the divided and different interests of that different ethnic
And these groups. Forces that began to divide the cultures, the Ukrainian from the Russian cultures in Ukraine, was that put upon this – they were united against the corrupt government. The corrupt government was ushered out. So where did the divisions come from? Did they come from outside of Ukraine as a pawn, a power play in a Russian, European, and American sort of geopolitical game? Or did it come from within the state?
I think it's a combination. So these divisions have always existed, obviously. I mean, I grew up observing them on an everyday basis. However, they have been emphasized and maybe made much more salient than they would have been by the, you know, the different geopolitical powers that kind of started fighting over Ukraine as a strategic turf. Unfortunately, I do believe that Crimea and maybe in the future other southeastern regions in Ukraine have become a pawn in the larger geopolitical game between the West and Putin. Mm-hmm. And I would say that I'm apprehensive to think that either side, either Russia or the West, are really aware or attuned to the actual interests of Ukrainians. You know, rather, both sides are trying to make a point.
You mentioned as a child, you grew up in Crimea. You learned Russian and also Ukrainian. Parents, ethnic Russians, as are you. As a child, I wonder if you can remember, what did society tell you growing up? and you alluded to this just a moment ago, that what was the difference between being a Ukrainian and a Russian? Help us understand that.
Right. So the difference was, I guess, the kind of stuff that you learned in school was a big difference, right? So the fact that Russian literature was prioritized over Ukrainian literature in the curriculum.
That was high culture.
Absolutely.
And Ukrainian was lower? In this sort of teaching.
Right. Maybe not necessarily lower, just not useful. You know, the kind of the primordial connection to that cultural heritage was not emphasized at all. You know, it was something that you could actually, you know, get a medical note to not attend Ukrainian classes the way that you could get yourself out of attending physical education classes.
Hmm.
Because nobody, you know, nobody felt kind of the connection, you know, that the types of fairy tales that my parents have told me growing up, the types of food that we ate at home, the literature that I was reading as a teenager was all Russian. It was not Ukrainian.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the media coverage in this country of this crisis? I don't know which media you consume, but I'd like to get your take on that, if it's been fair or perhaps biased against Russians.
Right. So this has been a really interesting thing for me to observe, because it has, I think, pointed to the issue of our, you know, kind of consumption of media without much reflection. Because I was able to follow Russian sources, Ukrainian sources, and American sources on the crisis, right? And all three are permeated with a quite different representation of events.
Characterize each one of them.
Sure. You know, there is quite a bit of propaganda, anti-Ukrainian propaganda in Russian sources. You know, the claims of, you know, fascism and ultra-right orientations on Maidan, which, again, are unsupported largely. Then Ukrainian media is quite biased against Russians. So, for instance, you know, there's constant reports of Russian pressure on Crimeans to vote one way or another, or the military presence in the peninsula. You know, my parents have not run into a single soldier throughout this month. So it's, you know,
Living in Crimea,
you know, their life has not changed in any way other than kind of having to deal with a panicky situation in terms of banks and money transactions. Now, the Western coverage has been really one-sided from my perspective, particularly the kind of the mainstream, you know, media.
How so? We have just a minute or two left.
Just a minute, right. So the immediate assumption that the new government in Kyiv was representative, was of all interest, of all Ukrainians, was not justified, in my view. Mm-hmm. It is not based on any evidence, right? So if you actually ask a panel of legal experts about whether or not this government is representative and democratic, I doubt they would say it is, right? So it's an empirical question. I don't know if it is or it is not. But our, you know, by our, I mean Western kind of undivided support thrown behind this government that is anti-Russian, just to me is a sign of, you know, using this whole situation as a political game of, you know, for the lack of better terms, sticking it to Russia
and perhaps latching on to Cold War feelings that were here for many decades in
absolutely,
the United States.
Absolutely, still exist, right, absolutely.
Very quickly, we have just a minute or so left. What do you see in the future? What are your hopes and fears for the coming days in your homeland?
Right. I really hope that this is going to be that the annexation of the Crimea is going to be the end of attacks against the territorial unity of Ukraine. I actually do think that it will be, in a sense that I agree with Roman. I think that, you know, the Russia will content itself with Crimea and has no further real, you know, imperialistic ambitions, despite the kind of the fear-mongering in the West. And my desire is that the elections of late May that are scheduled to take place in Kyiv will result in a democratic representation of all Ukrainians. And that the new government will protect the interests of Russian as well as Ukrainian ethnic nationals.
As a Russian immigrant to the United States, an ethnic Russian, have you
experienced any anti-Russian sentiments in the past few weeks because of the stir-up of the news and the Russian action?
Right. You know, it's a funny story that
– we only have about 30 seconds. Sorry.
Right. Most people think of me as a Ukrainian, and the distinction between Russian ethnic Ukrainian and Ukrainian ethnic Ukrainian is way too complicated for a lot of my acquaintances, you know. So, no. The brief answer is no, because I am considered Ukrainian.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming in and talking with us. Marina Zalosnaya.
Thank you very much for having me.
Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Iowa. Been very valuable to have your view, and we perhaps would like to invite you back in as this story develops, hopefully not escalates. Thank you. Tomorrow on this program, Russia and Ukraine will be part of our topic on Politics Day. Today we say farewell to the other Ben on our talk show team, Ben Stanton. Over the past year, Ben Stanton has been a huge part of making our talk shows sound as good as they do. Ben, we will dearly miss your expertise, your hard work, and your special brand of humor. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.